Chapter 35. The Path Within. The rainy season had come and gone, and our angel-faced stonecutter had excavated some 2,000 blocks of red laterite, when Satchapriya abruptly called off the whole industrial school project. For several months he had thought of little else. Leaving me to give the children their free milk, he had frequently spent the whole day in town, returning only at about 6 o'clock, in time for the evening meditation. Now the tide had turned. A strong reaction had at last set in. He was tired of social work, tired of having to meet people. He did not want to have anything more to do with blueprints and builders' estimates. All he wanted to do was to meditate. Industrial schools were all very well in their own way, but to provide them was no part of the duty of one who had renounced the world and dedicated himself to the spiritual life. His duty, indeed his sole duty, was to realize the truth. Acting on this newfound understanding, Satchapriya promptly drew up an ambitious program of meditation, hatha yoga exercises, and scriptural study that would keep him busy from early in the morning until late at night. It was, indeed, one of his most outstanding characteristics that he did nothing by halves. Everything was to him either black or white, and he could therefore commit himself to whatever happened to be his current conviction or enthusiasm without hesitation, reservation, or qualification. Doubts were traitors. Fears were liars. Having wound up the industrial school committee and discontinued the daily milk distribution and the weekly bhajan session, he therefore plunged into full-time spiritual practice as wholeheartedly as he had previously plunged into social work. Visitors were discouraged. Soon there descended upon the ashram a silence that was hardly ever broken by the sound of intruding footsteps. Though the rapidity and completeness of Satchapriya's vault fuss took me by surprise, it did not at first make any significant difference to my own routine. Study, meditation, and literary work were my only real interests, and these I had diligently pursued ever since our arrival in Muvattuputsa. During the 3 or 4 months that my friend had been preoccupied with plans for the industrial school, his repeated absences from the ashram had indeed given me additional time for reflection, and a number of things had become clear to me. 6 years had passed since I had first read the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Wei Lang, and realized that I was a Buddhist. During that time I had read much, not only about Buddhism, but about Hinduism and other spiritual traditions. I had also had the opportunity of coming into personal contact with both Buddhists and Hindus. Very much to my regret, I had to admit that, so far, I had been more fortunate in my contacts with Hindus rather than Buddhists. Among the Buddhist monks I had met, there were none who could be compared with the Yoga Swami of Jaffna or with Anandamayi. Bhikkhu Soma was perhaps comparable with Swami Pavrichananda, but on the whole, such Theravadin monks as I had encountered had impressed me as less active, less cultured, and less spiritually alive than their counterparts in the Ramakrishna mission. But for all these disappointments, I was more of a Buddhist than ever. Indeed, so firmly was I convinced of the truth of Buddhism that even had I never met another Buddhist whom I could respect, or had I been the only Buddhist in the world, it would have been quite impossible for me to follow any other path. My present isolation in the midst of a completely Hindu environment served only to intensify my awareness of Buddhism. Encounters with one or other manifestation of the harsh and divisive spirit of the caste system reminded me of Buddhism's compassionate concern for the welfare of all sentient beings. Pious references to God or to the Supreme Self recalled Buddhism's rejection of a supreme being and of an unchanging immortal soul. Partly as a result of this conflict with Hinduism, partly as a result of its own natural development, at this period my faith in Buddhism underwent a significant change. From being a quasi-instinctive attraction, a sort of spiritual falling in love, it became more of the nature of a reasoned conviction that included understanding as well as emotion, clarity as well as passion. While in Calcutta, I had immersed myself in the writings of D.T. Suzuki, particularly in his Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism and Essays in Zen Buddhism, both of which had given me further tantalizing glimpses into the magical world of the Mahayana. Now, relying mainly on Bhikkhu Thilachara's translation of the first 50 discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya, or collection of middle-length discourses of the Buddha, and on Mrs. Rhys-David's Home University Library book on Buddhism, I started exploring colder and clearer regions of the spirit. Three of the Buddha's teachings in particular drew my attention. These were the doctrine of dependent origination, or conditioned co-production, the Four Noble Truths, and the Three Characteristics of Conditioned Existence. Previously, though they were all well known to me, I had given them very little systematic attention. Now they occupied my mind virtually to the exclusion of everything else. Besides reflecting on them during the day, I meditated on them at night. Or rather, as I meditated, flashes of insight into the transcendental truths of which they were the expression in conceptual terms would sometimes spontaneously arise. Something of this concern with the fundamentals of what, for want of a better word, we call Buddhist thought, appears in the articles I wrote at this time. Several of them deal, in one way or another, with the doctrine of anatta, which represents the Buddha's realization of the fact that the soul, atta, is not an entity, but a process. So that if one's definition of reality involves the notion of permanence, the soul is necessarily unreal. One of these articles, entitled The Goal of Life's Endeavour, was the cause of serious unpleasantness with Satchapriya. It had been written specially for the Silver Jubilee souvenir, published by the local printing press, the proprietor of which was an ashram member. After Satchapriya had read it, I pointed out to him that the structure of the article corresponded to that of the Four Noble Truths. Instead of being pleased with this device, as I had expected, he became almost insane with fury. I was trying to propagate Buddhism by underhand methods. I was trying to undermine Hinduism, he shouted. He would expose me. He would denounce me to the authorities. He would see that I was imprisoned. It was an hour before he calmed down. Eventually he admitted that, even though I was seriously at fault, he ought not to have become so angry, and declared that, since his fault balanced mine, he would forgive me for what I had done to him, even though with my usual intransigence I refused to acknowledge that I was in the wrong. Despite the fact that the peace and tranquility of the ashram were occasionally shattered by outbursts of this kind, which more often than not he bitterly regretted, Satchapriya adhered faithfully to the program he had set himself, and soon had more than made up for lost time. With Hatha Yoga, the traditional Indian system of physical exercises, he was already familiar, having practiced it in his youth. Now, with renewed enthusiasm, he not only brushed up on what he already knew, but wrote off to Bombay for a series of bulky modern treatises on the subject, as well as for translations of the classical Sanskrit texts. Some of these volumes I too read, including the well-known Hatha Yoga Pradipika and Garanda Samhita. Under Satchapriya's guidance, I also took up various exercises, and while showing no great aptitude for the subject, eventually succeeded in mastering 8 or 9 elementary asanas or postures. Though I knew that in modern India, Hatha Yoga was often treated as an end in itself, rather than as a means to an end, the importance for the spiritual life of physical health and vigour was obvious, and there seemed to be no reason for not utilising the ancient discipline in the manner originally intended. One day, probably in connection with some new exercises about which Satchapriya had been reading, the question of fasting arose. after discussing the matter thoroughly and informing ourselves of the precautions to be taken, we decided to experiment, first with a 2-day fast and then with one lasting a whole week. Fasting was, we knew, a time-honoured spiritual discipline. Ancient sages had sometimes fasted for months on end. Even in these degenerate modern days, Mahatma Gandhi had more than once fasted for several weeks, admittedly for political rather than spiritual reasons. While among ordinary people, fasting on the anniversary of the death of one's father or mother, or at certain phases of the moon, was still a common practice. Fasting helped to destroy craving, not only craving for food, but for material things in general. It enabled one to recognize the strength of one's attachments. It was conducive to peace and serenity of mind. Moreover, fasting was good for health. It expelled toxins from the body and purified the whole system. With all this ringing in our ears, we started our experiment. The 2-day fast went off smoothly enough, and after allowing a week to pass, we told Shankara Pillai that for the next 7 days he would be cooking only for himself. Before we actually started, the idea of fasting for a whole week seemed slightly suicidal. It was as though, in depriving ourselves of food for so long a period, we were deliberately taking a look into the face of death. But we need not have worried. On the 3rd day, as the stomach reached the limit of its contractions, we felt extremely hungry, and visions of ravishing dishes danced before our eyes. Occasionally there was a slight fever and dizziness, due, I learned later, not to bodily weakness, but to the expulsion of toxins. These were the only discomforts we experienced. Towards the end of the week, especially, we felt light, almost weightless, as though we hardly belonged to the world at all. The mind, once its initial reactions had subsided, became calm and bright. There was no desire to do anything, and no desire not to do anything. We sauntered about the courtyard, or sat in our room, silent, aware, content. During these and subsequent fasts, we consumed only water, with perhaps a few drops of lime juice. Tea, in any case, we never took. Since our arrival in Muvattuputta, we had stewed both tea and coffee. Whether at the houses of our friends or in the ashram, we drank either water or one or another of the traditional Malayali thirst quenchers. Among the latter were a preparation of whey, flavoured with salt, fresh ginger, green chilies, and a local green herb, a mixture of molasses and water, and jeeram velam, a popular drink made from a kind of seed and taken hot after meals. Partly on principle, partly for reasons of economy, we lived a life of extreme simplicity. For a long time we did without soap, this being esteemed a luxury in the villages of South India, and as such not suitable for those who had given up the world. Toothbrushes and toothpaste had been replaced by the cheaper and no less effective margosa twig and rolled mango leaf. As for clothes, we were still wearing the Gerua-stained shirts and sarongs in which we had left Kasauli more than a year ago, and these, having been laundered almost daily in the Indian manner, were now becoming in places more than a little threadbare. Since the day that Satchipriya had called off the industrial school project, neither he nor I had gone outside the ashram compound. Indeed, to save time, we had discontinued the practice of going down to the river every morning for our bath, and instead now took it standing in the stone cistern beside the well. After the thick whirl rope had run through our fingers, there would be a faint splash as the bucket hit the surface of the water 60 or 70 feet below. Then, when a sudden drag on the rope had signalled a full bucket, the long, slow haul to the top would begin. Even in the hottest weather, the water was always icy cold, and I finished quickly, ladling only one or two bucketfuls of water over me, to Satchaprias 4 or 5. One morning I had an extremely unpleasant experience. As I picked up my towel from the edge of the cistern, something suddenly stung me in the wrist. It was a scorpion. Within minutes, the venom had spread all the way up my left arm, which rapidly became puffed and swollen. The pain was excruciating. On hearing my calls, Satchapriya and Shankara Pillai came rushing to my assistance, and were soon vigorously rubbing the affected arm with ashes, this being the traditional local remedy. Fortunately, the scorpion was not fully grown, otherwise the sting might have proved fatal. As it was, my arm remained swollen and painful for a whole week, and I felt very feverish. What with meditation and hatha yoga, as well as study and literary work, not to speak of fasting, the weeks slipped by almost without our noticing. One day, it occurred to us that well over a month had passed since we had last called on the ashram members, and that subscriptions were long overdue. What was to be done? Unless we took prompt action, some of the subscriptions might lapse, in which case the ashram finances would suffer. Formerly, Satchapriya would have leapt to his feet, seized his account book, and been out of the gate and on the road into town in a flash. Now, however, he flatly refused to go. Worldly people were all hypocrites, he declared. Despite their nauseating protestations of piety and devotion, they were mean and deceitful in the extreme, the slaves of every imaginable kind of weakness and depravity. Worst of all, they wallowed day and night in the mire of sensuality, and he wanted to have nothing whatever to do with them. In future, I would have to go out and collect the monthly subscriptions by myself. People liked me, he averred, rather equivocally in the circumstances, whereas they disliked him for his honesty and straightforwardness, and they would be glad to see me on my own. The latter part of his statement, unfortunately, was only too true. On some people, Satchapriya's rough speech and overbearing manner, as well as his morbid quickness to take offence, had made a distinctly unfavourable impression. Others, recognising his fundamental goodness of heart, were able to overlook the less attractive manifestations of this sturdy independence of spirit. Besides, Hinduism had a long and highly respectable tradition of hot-tempered sages, and it was not difficult for them to assimilate him to some peppery Vedic original. At first, the ashram members and other friends whom I visited clearly thought that, with Satchapriya out of the way, they would be able to extract from me the precious secret of my caste and nationality without much difficulty. But to their disappointment, I proved no less intractable than he had been. If anything, I was more difficult to handle. Instead of reacting to the more impertinent inquiries with angry impatience, as he had sometimes done, I stonewalled them with a joke, with one of their own favourite philosophical generalisations, or with a bland smile. Despite such intransigence, however, the fact that I now came to see them on my own, without Satchapriya, soon put my relationship with many of the ashram members on a more friendly footing. Previously, Satchapriya had always done most of the talking, while I either remained silent or contributed to the discussion no more than an occasional remark. This led to my acquiring an entirely undeserved reputation for taciturnity, if not downright unsociability. In the eyes of some of our friends, of course, taciturnity was a sign of spirituality. Others believed that I spoke so little not from choice but from necessity, my English being less perfect than that of my friend. The truth of the matter was that I knew from repeated bitter experience that if Satchapriya thought I was giving people the impression that I knew something that he did not know, especially about philosophy or religion, or if they showed the slightest sign of paying greater attention to me than to him, or of valuing my opinion more, there would be trouble. On one occasion, thinking that I was about to speak, Kumaran Nair had interrupted him with the words, "Be quiet, Swamiji is going to say something." The repercussions of this unfortunate incident lasted for days. In the end, I learned that trouble could be avoided and peace preserved only by my saying as little as possible, and ensuring that, in any conversation or discussion, Satchapriya always occupied the centre of the stage. Had I been a Christian, such self-effacement would doubtless have been regarded as providing a lesson in humility. Being a Buddhist, I took it as an exercise in mindfulness. Not only did I have to watch carefully over what I said, when I did say anything, but also to observe the effects of my words on other people, especially on Satchapriya. Good for me though this training undoubtedly was, it was a strain to have to keep it up for so long, and for such reasons. Indeed, it was only after I had started collecting the ashram subscriptions on my own and could once more talk freely with people that I realized how great the strain had been. For their part, the ashram members could not help noticing the change and not only eagerly plied me with questions, but asked for advice on various personal matters. Though the last thing I wanted to do was give the impression of having been held in check by Satchapriya, they clearly felt that, now I was on my own, a barrier had been removed, and once I had made my position clear on the burning topic of caste and nationality, we were able to have a number of serious and worthwhile discussions. Satchapriya himself, however, was not by any means very happy about these developments. On my departure from the ashram, he would warn me not to waste time talking to people, especially the Christians, and on my return always cross-examined me closely as to whom I had met and what had been said. Sometimes, indeed, he acted as though I could not be trusted, and that if he was not careful, I would enter into a conspiracy with the Christians against him.